Prime Minister Narendra Modi has been a member of the RSS all his life. He's a creation of the RSS. In Modi's second term, the RSS has stepped up its game like never before. It is no longer a shadow state or a parallel state. It is the state. Day by day, we see examples of its control over the media, the police, the intelligence agencies. Worryingly, it appears to exercise considerable influence over the armed forces too.
That's Arundhati Roy, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Arundhati Roy on Modi's India. The India of its current Prime Minister, Narendra Modi, is a far cry from the India of Gandhi and Nehru. Tolerance and secularism are being replaced by Hindutva, a Hindu nationalist ideology which seeks to establish Hindu dominance in a country where there are hundreds of millions of religious minorities. Modi is the head of the Bharatiya Janata Party, the BJP. It is the political arm of the Rashtriya Swayamsevak Sangh, the RSS. The RSS was explicitly influenced by European fascist movements. Its leading politicians regularly praised Hitler and Mussolini. India's Muslim population of 200 million has been singled out by Modi. Islamophobia has resulted in murders, massacres, and lynchings of Muslims. There have been demonstrations all over India protesting Modi's policies. Muslim-majority Kashmir continues to remain under military rule. To talk about Modi's India is Arundhati Roy. She's a world-renowned writer and global justice activist. Her latest book is a collection of her essays, My Seditious Heart. She gave the Jonathan Schell Memorial Lecture at Cooper Union in New York. And now, Arundhati Roy.
Right now, 7 million people in the Valley of Kashmir, overwhelming numbers of whom do not wish to be citizens of India and have fought for decades for their right to self-determination, are locked down under a digital siege and the densest military occupation in the world. Simultaneously, in the eastern state of Assam, almost 2 million people who long to belong to India have found their names missing from the National Register of Citizens and risk being declared stateless. The Indian government has announced its intention of extending the NRC to the rest of India. This could lead to the manufacture of statelessness on a scale previously unknown. The rich in Western countries are making their own arrangements for the coming climate calamity. They are building bunkers and stocking reservoirs of food and clean water. In poor countries, and India, despite being the fifth largest economy in the world, is shamefully still a poor and hungry country, different kinds of arrangements are being made. The Indian government's 5th August 2019 annexation of Kashmir has as much to do with India's imminent water crisis and the urgency to secure access to the five rivers that run through the state of Jammu and Kashmir as it does with anything else. And the National Register of Citizens, which will create a system of tiered citizenship in which some citizens have more rights than others, is also a preparation for a time when resources become scarce. The dismantling of the idea of liberty, fraternity, and equality will be, in fact, already is, the first calamity, the first casualty of the climate crisis. I'm going to try to explain in some detail how this is happening and how in India the modern management system that has emerged to handle this very modern crisis has its roots in an odious, dangerous filament of our history. The violence of inclusion and the violence of exclusion are precursors of a convulsion that could alter the foundations of India and rearrange its meaning, and its place in the world. The Constitution calls India a secular socialist republic. We use the word secular in a slightly different sense from the rest of the world. For us, it's code for a society in which all religions have equal standing in the eyes of the law. In practice, India has been neither secular nor socialist. In effect, it has always functioned as an upper caste Hindu state. But the conceit of secularism, hypocritical though it may be, is the only shard of coherence that makes India possible. That hypocrisy was the best thing we had. Without it, India will end. In his May 2019 victory speech, after his party won a second term, Prime Minister Narendra Modi boasted that no politician from any political party had dared to use the word secularism in their campaigns. The tank of secularism, Modi said, was now empty. So it's official. India is running on empty. And we are learning too late to cherish hypocrisy, because with it comes a vestige, a pretense at least, of remembered decency. India is not really a country. It's a continent, more complex and diverse, with more languages, 780 at last count, excluding dialects, more nationalities and sub-nationalities, more indigenous tribes and religions than all of Europe. Imagine this vast ocean, this fragile, fractious social ecosystem suddenly being commandeered by a Hindu supremacist organization that believes in a doctrine of one nation, one language, one religion, one constitution. I'm speaking here of the RSS, the Rashtriya Swayam Sevak Sangh, founded in 1925, the mothership of the ruling Bharatiya Janata Party. Its founding fathers were greatly influenced by German and Italian fascism. They likened the Muslims of India to the Jews of Germany and believed that Muslims have no place in Hindu India. The RSS today, in typical RSS chameleon speak, distances itself from this view. But its underlying ideology, in which Muslims are cast as permanent, treacherous outsiders, is a constant refrain in the public speeches of the BJP. Of BJP politicians, and finds utterance in chilling slogans raised by rampaging mobs. For example, Musalman ka ek hi sthan, Kabristan ya Pakistan. Only one place for the Musalman, the graveyard or Pakistan. In October this year, Mohan Bhagwat, supreme leader of the RSS, said, India is a Hindu Rashtra, a Hindu nation, and this is non-negotiable. That idea turns everything that is beautiful about India into acid. If Nazi Germany was a country seeking to impose its imagination onto a continent and beyond, the impetus of an RSS rule India is, in a sense, the opposite. Here is a continent seeking to shrink itself into a country. Not even a country, but a province, a primitive ethno-religious province. This is turning out to be an unimaginably violent process, a kind of slow-motion political fission, triggering a radioactivity that has begun to contaminate everything around it. That it will self-destruct is not in doubt. The question is, what else, who else, and how much else will go down with it? None of the white supremacist neo-Nazi groups that are on the rise in the world today can boast of the infrastructure and manpower that the RSS commands. It has 57,000 branches across the country and an armed, dedicated militia of 600,000 volunteers. It runs schools in which millions of students are enrolled and has its own medical missions, trade unions, farmers' organizations, media outlets, and women's groups. Under its saffron pennant, a whole host of far-right organizations known as the Sangh Parivar, the RSS family, have prospered and multiplied. These organizations are the political equivalent of shell companies and are responsible for shockingly violent attacks on minorities in which, over the years, uncounted thousands have been murdered. Violence, communal conflagration, and false flag attacks are their principal strategies and have been at the very core of the Saffron campaign. Prime Minister Narendra Modi has been a member of the RSS all his life. He is a creation of the RSS, and although not Brahmin, he, more than anyone else in its history, has been responsible for turning it into the most powerful organization in India and for writing its most glorious chapter yet. It's exasperating to have to constantly repeat the story of Modi's ascent to power, but the officially sanctioned amnesia around it makes reiteration almost a duty. Modi's political career was jump-started in October 2001 when the BJP removed its elected chief minister in the state of Gujarat and installed Modi in his place. He was not at the time even an elected member of the state's legislative assembly. 3 months into his first term, there was a heinous but mysterious act of arson in which 59 Hindu pilgrims were burned to death in a train coach. As revenge, quote unquote, Hindu vigilante mobs went on a well-planned rampage across the state. An estimated 2,500 people, almost all of them Muslim, were murdered in broad daylight. Women were gang-raped and killed on city streets, and tens of thousands of people were driven from their homes. Immediately after the pogrom, Modi called for elections. He won, not despite the massacre, but because of it. He became known as Hindu Hriday Samrat, the emperor of the Hindu heart, and was re-elected as chief minister for 3 consecutive terms. When Modi was sworn in as India's 14th prime minister, he was celebrated not just by his support base of Hindu nationalists, but also by India's major industrialists and businessmen, by many Indian liberals, and by the international media as the epitome of hope and progress, a savior in a saffron business suit whose very person represented the confluence of the ancient and the modern, of Hindu nationalism and no-holds-barred free market capitalism. While Modi has delivered on Hindu nationalism, he has stumbled badly on the free market front. Through a series of blunders, he has brought India's economy to its knees. In 2016, a little over a year into his first term, he appeared one night on TV to announce that from that moment on, all 500 and 1,000 rupee banknotes, that's over 80% of the currency in circulation, had ceased to be legal tender. Nothing like it had ever been done before in the history of any country. This was pure quack economics, a home remedy being laid on a nation of more than a billion people. It turned out to be nothing short of devastating. But there were no riots, no protests. People stood meekly in line outside banks for hours on end to deposit their old currency notes, the only way left to redeem them. Almost overnight, jobs disappeared, the construction industry ground to a halt, small businesses simply shut down. Some of us foolishly believed that this act of unimaginable hubris would be the end of Modi. How wrong we were. People rejoiced. They suffered, but they rejoiced. It was as though pain had been spun into pleasure, as though their suffering was the labor pain that would soon birth a glorious, prosperous Hindu India. Most economists agree that demonetization was the policy equivalent of shooting out the tires of a speeding car. Many argue that the official figures the government has since put out about economic growth, depressing as they already are experiments with the truth. They argue that the Indian economy is now in recession and that demonetization was the catalyst. Even the government admits that unemployment is at a 45-year high. The 2019 Global Hunger Index ranks India 102nd out of 117 countries. The moment we as a people accepted demonetization, we infantilized ourselves and surrendered to tin pot authoritarianism. But what was bad for the country turned out to be excellent for the BJP. Between 2016 and 2017, even as the country's economy tanked, it became the richest political party in the world. Its income increased by 81%, making it 5 times richer than its main rival, the Congress Party, whose income declined by 14%. And this war chest won the BJP the crucial state elections in Uttar Pradesh and turned the 2019 general elections into a race between a Ferrari and a few old bicycles. And since elections are increasingly about money and the accumulation of power and the accumulation of capital seem to be convergent, the chances of a free and fair election in the near future seem remote. So maybe demonetization was not a blunder after all. In Modi's second term, the RSS has stepped up its game like never before. It is no longer a shadow state or a parallel state. It is the state. Day by day, we see examples of its control over the media, the police, the intelligence agencies. Worryingly, it appears to exercise considerable influence over the armed forces, too. Foreign diplomats and ambassadors have been trooping to the RSS headquarters in Nagpur to pay their respects. In truth, things have reached a stage where control is no longer even necessary. More than 24/7 TV news channels and tens of thousands of WhatsApp and TikTok groups keep the population marinated in a hothouse of around-the-clock drip feed of frenzied bigotry. On the 9th of November, the Supreme Court of India ruled on what some have called the most important case in the world. On the 6th of December 1992, in the town of Ayodhya, a Hindu vigilante mob organized by the BJP and the Vishwa Hindu Parishad, the World Hindu Council, literally hammered a 450-year-old mosque into dust. They claimed that the mosque was built on the ruins of a Hindu temple that had marked the birthplace of Lord Ram. More than 2,000 people were killed in communal violence that followed the demolition. In his recent judgment, the court held that Muslims could not prove their exclusive and continuous possession of the site, and it entrusted the site to a trust to be constituted by the BJP government tasked with building a temple on it. There have been mass arrests of people who have criticized the judgment. The VHP has refused to back down on its past statements that it will now turn its attention to other mosques. Theirs can be an endless campaign. After all, everybody came from somewhere, and everything is built on something. In order to consolidate their political gains, the RSS and the BJP's main strategy is to generate long-lasting chaos on an industrial scale. They have stocked their kitchen with a set of simmering cauldrons that can, whenever necessary, be quickly brought to the boil. On the 5th of August 2019, the Indian Parliament unilaterally breached the fundamental conditions of the instrument of accession by which the former princely states of Jammu and Kashmir agreed to become part of India in 1947. It stripped Jammu and Kashmir of statehood and its special status, which included its right to have its own constitution and its own flag. The dissolution of the legal entity of the state also meant the dissolution of Section 35A, one of the Indian Constitution, which secured the erstwhile state's residents the rights and privileges and made them stewards of their own territory. In preparation for the move, the government flew in more than 50,000 troops to supplement the hundreds of thousands already stationed there. By the night of the 4th of August, tourists and pilgrims had been evacuated from the Kashmir Valley. Schools and markets were shut down. More than 4,000 people arrested. That included politicians, businessmen, lawyers, rights activists, local leaders, students, and three former chief ministers. Kashmir's entire political class, including those who have been loyal to India, were incarcerated. By midnight, the internet was cut and the phones went dead. The abrogation of Kashmir's special status, the promise of an All India National Register of Citizens, the building of the Ram Temple in Ayodhya are all on the front burners of the RSS and BJP kitchen. To reignite flagging passions, all they need to do is to pick a villain from their gallery and unleash their dogs of war. There are several categories of villains: Pakistani jihadis, Kashmiri terrorists, Bangladeshi infiltrators, or any one of a population of nearly 200 million Indian Muslims who can always be accused of being Pakistan lovers or anti-national traitors. Each of these cards is held hostage to the other and often made to stand in for the other. They have little to do with each other and are often hostile to each other because their needs, desires, ideologies, and situations are not just inimical, but end up posing an existential threat to one another simply because they're all Muslim. They have to suffer the consequences of each other's actions. In two national elections now, the BJP has shown that it can win a brute majority in parliament without the Muslim vote. As a result, Indian Muslims have been effectively disenfranchised and are becoming that most vulnerable of people, a community without political representation and without a voice. Various forms of undeclared social boycott are pushing them down the economic ladder, and for reasons of physical security, into ghettos. Indian Muslims have also lost their place in the mainstream media. The only Muslim voices we hear on TV shows are the absurd ones of those few who are constantly and deliberately invited on to play the part of the primitive Islamist Maulana to make things worse than they already are. Other than that, the only acceptable public speech for the Muslim community is to constantly reiterate and demonstrate its loyalty to the Indian flag. So while Kashmiris, brutalized as they are because of their history and more importantly their geography, still have a lifeboat, the dream of azadi, of freedom, Indian Muslims have to stay on deck to help fix the broken ship. The lynching of Tabriz Ansari illustrates just how broken the ship is and how deep the rot. Lynching, as you in the United States well know, is a public performance of ritualized murder in which a man or woman is killed to remind their community that it lives at the mercy of the mob, and that the police, the law, the government, as well as the good people in their homes who wouldn't hurt a fly, who go to work and take care of their families, are friends of the mob. Tabriz was lynched this June. He was an orphan raised by his uncles in the state of Jharkhand. As a teenager, he went away to the city of Pune, where he found a job as a welder. When he turned 22, he returned home to get married. The day after his wedding to 18-year-old Shahista, Tabriz was caught by a mob, tied to a lamppost, beaten for hours, and forced to chant the new Hindu war cry, Jai Shri Ram, victory to Lord Ram. The police eventually took him into custody but refused to allow his distraught family and young bride to take him to hospital. Instead, they accused him of being a thief and produced him before a magistrate who sent him back to custody, where he died 4 days later. In his latest report, the National Crime Records Bureau has carefully left out data on mob lynching. According to the Indian news site, The Quint, there have been 113 deaths by mob violence since 2015. Lynchers and others accused in hate crimes, including mass murder, have been rewarded with public office and honored by ministers in Modi's cabinet. Mohan Bhagwat, the supreme leader of the RSS, has said that lynching is a Western concept imported from the Bible and that Hindus have no such tradition. He has declared that all talk of a lynching epidemic is a conspiracy to defame India. We know what happened in Europe when an organization with a similar ideology imposed itself first on a country and then sought Lebensraum. We know that it happened because the rest of the world did not pay heed to the early warnings from those who saw and heard enough to know what was coming. Perhaps those warnings did not sound balanced and moderate enough to a masculine Anglo-Saxon world suspicious of any overt display of distress or emotion. But a certain kind of over-the-top emotion, however, is still clearly acceptable. There was plenty on display in the United States on the 22nd of September 2019, when 60,000 Indian Americans gathered at the NRG Stadium in Houston for the Howdy Modi extravaganza. It has already become the stuff of urban legend. President Donald Trump was gracious enough to allow a visiting prime minister to introduce him as a special guest in his own country to his own citizens. Several members of the US Congress spoke, their smiles too wide, their bodies arranged in attitudes of ingratiation. Over a crescendo of drum rolls and wild cheering, the adoring crowd chanted, "Modi, Modi, Modi." At the end of the show, Trump and Modi linked hands and did a victory lap. The stadium exploded. In India, the noise was amplified 1,000 times over by carpet coverage on TV channels, and Howdy became a Hindi word. Meanwhile, news organizations ignored the thousands of people protesting outside the stadium. Not all the roaring of the 60,000 in the Houston stadium could mask deafening silence from Kashmir. That day, 22nd September, marked the 48th day of curfew and communication blockade in the valley. Once again, Modi has managed to unleash his unique brand of cruelty on a scale unheard of in modern times. And once again, it has endeared him further to his loyal public. When the Jammu and Kashmir Reorganization Bill was passed in India's parliament, on August 6th, there were celebrations across the political spectrum. Sweets were distributed in offices, and there was dancing in the streets. A conquest, a colonial annexation, another triumph for the Hindu nation was being celebrated. Once again, the conqueror's eyes fell on the two primeval trophies of conquest, women and land. Statements by senior BJP politicians and patriotic pop videos that notched up millions of views legitimized this indecency. Google Trends showed a surge in searches for the phrases marry a Kashmiri girl and buy land in Kashmir.
You're listening to Arundhati Roy on Modi's India. You can order copies of this program by calling 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order online on our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
In the early days of the lockdown, little news came out of the valley. Kashmiri newspapers were completely censored. They carried pages and pages of news about cancelled weddings, the effects of climate change, the conservation of lakes and wildlife sanctuaries, tips on how to live with diabetes, and front-page government advertisements about the benefits that Kashmiris' new downgraded legal status would bring to the Kashmiri people. These benefits are likely to include the building of big dams that control and commandeer the water from the rivers that flow through Kashmir in order to address India's looming water crisis. They will certainly include the erosion that results from deforestation, the destruction of the fragile Himalayan ecosystem, and the plunder of Kashmir's bountiful natural wealth by Indian corporations. Real reporting about ordinary people's lives came mostly from journalists and photographers working for the international media, Agence France-Presse, the Associated Press, Al Jazeera, The Guardian, the BBC, The New York Times, and Washington Post. The reporters, mostly Kashmiris, working in an information vacuum with none of the tools usually available to modern-day reporters, traveled through their homeland at great risk to themselves to bring us the news. And the news was of nighttime raids, of young men being rounded up and beaten for hours, their screams broadcast on public address systems for their neighbors and families to hear, of soldiers entering villagers' homes and mixing fertilizer and kerosene into their winter food stocks. The news was of teenagers with their bodies peppered with shotgun pellets being treated at home because they'd be arrested if they went to hospital. The news was of hundreds of children being whisked away in the dead of night, of parents debilitated by desperation and anxiety. The news was of fear and anger, depression, confusion, steely resolve, and incandescent resistance. But the Home Minister, Amit Shah, said the siege only existed in people's imaginations. Imagine if all of New York City were put under an information lockdown and a curfew managed by hundreds of thousands of soldiers. Imagine the streets of your city remapped by razor wire and torture centers. Imagine if mini Abu Ghraibs appeared in your neighborhoods. Imagine thousands of you being arrested and your families not knowing where you have been taken. Imagine not being able to communicate with anybody, not your neighbor, not your loved ones, outside the city, no one in the outside world for weeks together. And then imagine being told that all of this was for your own good. The horror that Kashmiris have endured over the last few months comes on top of the trauma of a 30-year-old armed conflict that has already taken 70,000 lives and covered their valley with graves. They have held out while everything was thrown at them: war, money, torture, mass disappearance, an army of more than 500,000 soldiers, and a smear campaign in which an entire population has been portrayed as murderous fundamentalists. The new phase of the Kashmir conflict has already begun. Militants have warned that from now on, all Indians will be considered legitimate targets. More than 10 people, mostly poor non-Kashmiri migrant workers, have been shot already. Yes, it's the poor, almost always the poor, who get caught in the line of fire. It's going to get ugly, very ugly, but soon all this recent history will be forgotten, and once again there will be debates in TV studios that create an equivalence between atrocities by Indian security forces and Kashmiri militants. Speak of Kashmir, and the Indian government and its media will immediately tell you about Pakistan, deliberately conflating the misdeeds of a hostile foreign state with the democratic aspirations of ordinary people living under a military occupation. The Indian government has made it clear that the only option for Kashmiris is complete capitulation, that no form of resistance is acceptable, violent, non-violent, spoken, written, or sung. Yet Kashmiris know that to exist, they must resist. Why should they want to be part of India? For what earthly reason? If freedom is what they want, freedom is what they should have. It's what Indians should want too, not on behalf of Kashmiris, but for their own sake. The atrocity being committed in their name involves a form of corrosion that India will not survive. Kashmir may not defeat India, but it will consume India. In many ways, it already has. Like Kashmir, Assam is a border state with a history of multiple sovereignties, with centuries of migration, wars, invasions, continuously shifting borders, British colonialism, and more than 70 years of electoral democracy that has only deepened the fault lines in a dangerously combustible society. That an exercise like the NRC even took place has to do with Assam's very particular cultural history. It was among the territories ceded to the British by the Burmese in the peace treaty signed after the First Anglo-Burmese War in 1826. At the time, it was a densely forested, scantily populated province, home to hundreds of communities, each with an organic, though often undocumented, relationship to the land. Like a microcosm of India, Assam has always been a collection of minorities jockeying to make alliances in order to manufacture a majority, ethnic as well as linguistic. And anything that altered or threatened the prevailing balance became a potential catalyst for violence. Towards the end of the 19th century, the British discovered that the climate and soil of the region were conducive to cultivating tea. Local people were unwilling to work as serfs in the gardens, so a large population of indigenous tribespeople were transported from central India. They were no different from the shiploads of indentured labor the British transported to their colonies all over the world. And by the late 1890s, as the tea industry grew and as the plains of neighboring East Bengal reached the limits of their cultivation potential, the British encouraged Bengali Muslim peasants, masters of the art of farming on the rich, silty riverine plains and shifting islands of the Brahmaputra, known as the Chor, to migrate to Assam. By 1930, migration had drastically changed the economy and the demography of Assam. At first, the migrants were welcomed by the Assamese, but soon tensions arose, ethnic, religious, and linguistic. Over the years, the borders of Assam were redrawn continuously, almost dizzyingly. So Assam became part of East Bengal, then it became part of Bengal. East Bengal became East Pakistan. East Pakistan became Bangladesh. There was the huge influx of refugees in 1947. And then after the Pakistan army's genocidal attack on East Pakistan, another huge influx of refugees in 1971. So Assam was a part of East Bengal, and then it wasn't. East Bengal became East Pakistan. East Pakistan became Bangladesh. Cities grew, forests were felled, marshes were reclaimed, tribal commons swallowed by modern development, and the fissures between people grew old and hard and intractable. The demand for a national register of citizens in Assam arose out of this unique, vexed, and complex history. Ironically, the word national here refers not so much to India as it does to the nation of Assam. The Assamese nationalists called for a boycott of elections unless foreigners were deleted from the electoral rolls, and the clarion call was for 3D, which stood for detect, delete, and deport. The number of so-called foreigners based on pure speculation was estimated to be between 5 and 8 million. The movement quickly turned violent. Killings, arson, bomb blasts, and mass demonstrations generated an atmosphere of hostility and almost uncontrollable rage towards outsiders. By 1979, the state was up in flames. Though the movement was primarily directed against Bengalis and Bengali speakers, Hindu communal forces within the movement gave it an anti-Muslim character too. In 1983, this culminated in the horrifying Nelly massacre, in which more than 2,000 Bengal origin Muslim settlers were murdered over 6 hours. In 1985, the student leaders of the Assam agitation won the state assembly elections and formed the government, and that same year signed the Assam Accord with the central government. A date was agreed upon. Those who arrived in Assam after midnight of the 24th of March, 1971, the day the Pakistani army began its attack on civilians in East Pakistan, would be expelled. And the updating of the NRC was meant to sift the genuine citizen of Assam from post-1971 infiltrators. In 2005, the Supreme Court, which until then the process was that the onus of proving that someone was not a citizen was up to the state. And in 2005, the Supreme Court switched that and put the onus of proving citizenship on the citizen. And this completely changed the legal paradigm and set the stage for the new updated NRC. In December 2014, the Supreme Court ordered that an updated list of the NRC be produced before the court within a year. Nobody had any clue about what could or would be done to the 5 million infiltrators that it was hoped would be detected. There was no question of them being deported to Bangladesh. Could that many people be locked up in detention camps? For how long? Would they be stripped of citizenship? Millions of villagers living in far-flung areas were expected to produce a specified set of documents, legacy papers, which proved direct and unbroken paternal lineage dating back to 1971. The Supreme Court's deadline turned the exercise into a nightmare. Impoverished, illiterate villagers were delivered into a labyrinth of bureaucracy, legalese, documentation, court hearings, and all the ruthless skullduggery that goes with it. In the less fertile chores I visited early last month, the poverty washes over you like the dark, silt-rich waters of the Brahmaputra. The only sign of modernity were the bright plastic bags containing documents which their owners, who quickly gather around visiting strangers, cannot read, but keep looking at anxiously as though trying to decrypt the faded shapes on the faded pages and work out whether they would save them and their children from the massive new detention camp they had heard is being constructed deep in the forests of Gwalpara. Imagine a whole population of millions of people like this, debilitated, rigid with fear and worry about their documentation. The NRC has spawned a vocabulary of its own. The saddest phrase in it is genuine citizen. In village after village, people told stories about being served notices late at night that ordered them to appear in court 200 or 300 kilometers away by next morning. They described the scramble to assemble family members and their documents, the treacherous ride in small rowboats across the rushing river in pitch darkness, the negotiations with canny transporters on the shore who had smelled their desperation and tripled their rates, the reckless drive through the night on dangerous highways. The most chilling story I heard was about a family traveling in a pickup truck that collided with a roadworks truck carrying barrels of tar. The barrels overturned and the injured family was covered in tar. When I went to visit them in the hospital, the young activist I was traveling with said, their young son was trying to pick off the tar on his skin and the tiny stones embedded in it. And he looked at his mother and said, will we ever get rid of the kala dag, the stigma of being foreigners? Despite reservations about the process and its implementation, the updating of the NRC was welcomed by everybody in Assam, each for reasons of their own. Assamese nationalists hoped that millions of Bengali infiltrators, Hindu as well as Muslim, would finally be detected and formally declared foreigners. Hindu as well as Muslims of Bengal origin wanted to see their names on the NRC to prove they were genuine Indians, so that the Kala Dag of being foreign could be laid to rest once and for all. And Hindu nationalists, now in government in Assam too, wanted to see millions of Muslim names deleted from the NRC. Everybody hoped for some kind of closure. After a series of postponements, the final updated list was published on the 31st of August 2019, and the name of 1.9 million people were missing. A great number of those who found their names missing are women and children, most of who belong to communities where women are married in their early teenage years and by custom have their name changed. They have no link documents to prove their legacy. A great number are illiterate people whose names or parents' names have been wrongly transcribed over the years. A Hassan with one S or two S's, a Joinul who became a Zainul. A single slip and you're out. If your father died or was estranged from your mother, if he didn't vote, wasn't educated, and didn't have land, you're out. Because mothers' legacies don't count. Among all the prejudices at play in updating the NRC, perhaps the greatest of all is the built-in structural prejudice against women and against the poor. And the poor in India today are made up mostly of Muslims, Dalit, and tribal. All the 1.9 million people whose names are missing will now have to appeal to a foreigner's tribunal, to hire lawyers, take loans to pay their fees, or sell their land and home and surrender to a life of debt. Many, of course, have no land or home to sell. Several people faced with this have committed suicide. After the whole exercise and the millions of rupees spent on it, all the stakeholders in the NRC are bitterly disappointed. Bengal origin migrants are disappointed because they know their rightful citizens have been arbitrarily left out. Assamese nationalists are disappointed because the list has fallen short of excluding the 5 million speculated infiltrators. India's ruling Hindu nationalists are disappointed because it is estimated that more than half of the 1.9 million are non-Muslims. So demands for a fresh NRC have already begun. Far from being deterred by the chaos and distress created by Assam's NRC, the Modi government is making arrangements to import it into the rest of India. It has drafted a new citizenship amendment bill, which it hopes to pass in the next session of Parliament. The Citizenship Amendment Bill, the CAB, says that all non-Muslim persecuted minorities from Pakistan, Bangladesh, and Afghanistan, meaning Hindus, Sikhs, Buddhists, and Christians, will be given asylum in India. By default, the CAB will ensure that those deprived of citizenship will only be Muslims. Before the process of the NRC and CAB begin, the plan is to draw up a national population register. This will involve a door-to-door survey in which, in addition to basic census data, the government plans to collect iris scans and other biometric data. It will be the mother of all data banks. The groundwork has already begun. As we've seen, the NRC in Assam grew out of a very particular history. To apply it to the rest of India is pure malevolence. How many people in India can produce legacy documents? We are being told that the India-wide NRC is an exercise to detect several million Bangladeshi infiltrators, termites, as our Home Minister likes to call them. There is no doubt that there are a great many undocumented workers from Bangladesh and India. There's also no doubt that they make up one of the poorest, most marginalized populations in the country. Anybody who claims to believe in the free market should know that they are only filling a vacant economic slot by doing work that others will not do, for wages that nobody else will accept. They are not the ones destroying the country, stealing public money, or bankrupting the banks. They're only a decoy, a Trojan horse for the RSS's real objective, its historic mission. The real purpose of an All India NRC coupled with the Citizenship Amendment Bill is to threaten, destabilize, and stigmatize the Indian Muslim community, particularly the poorest among them. It's meant to create a tiered citizenship in which one set of citizenships has no rights and lives at the mercy or on the goodwill of another. A modern caste system which will exist alongside the ancient one in which Muslims are the new Dalits, not notionally, but actually, legally. In places like West Bengal, where the BJP is on an aggressive takeover drive, suicides have already begun. Here is M.S. Golwalkar, the supreme leader of the RSS in 1940, writing in his book, We or Our Nationhood Defined, and here I quote, "Ever since that evil day when Muslims first landed in Hindustan, right up to the present moment, the Hindu nation has been gallantly fighting to take on these despoilers. The race spirit has been awakening. In Hindustan, land of the Hindus, lives and should live the Hindu nation. All others are traitors and enemies to the national cause, or to take a charitable view, idiots. The foreign races in Hindustan may stay in the country, wholly subordinated to the Hindu nation, claiming nothing, deserving no privileges, far less any preferential treatment, not even citizens' rights." And he continues, "To keep up the purity of its race and culture, Germany shocked the world by her purging the country of the Semitic races, the Jews. Race pride at its highest has been manifested here, a good lesson for us in Hindustan to learn and profit by." How do you translate this in modern terms, if not as the National Register of Citizens coupled with the Citizenship Amendment Bill? This is the RSS's version of Germany's 1935 Nuremberg laws, by which German citizens were only those who had been granted citizenship papers, legacy papers, by the government of the Third Reich. The amendment against Muslims is the first such amendment. Others will no doubt follow against Christians, Dalits, communists, all enemies of the RSS. The foreigners' tribunals and detention centers that have already started springing up across India may not at the moment be intended to accommodate hundreds of millions of Muslims, but they are meant to remind us that India's Muslims truly belong there, unless they can produce legacy papers, because only Hindus are considered India's real aboriginals, who don't need those papers. As we saw, even the 450-year-old Babri Masjid Mosque in Ayodhya couldn't produce its legacy papers. What chance would a poor farmer or a street vendor have? This is the wickedness that the 60,000 people in the Houston Stadium were cheering. This is what the President of the United States linked hands with Modi to support. It's what the Israelis want to partner with, the Germans want to trade with, the French want to sell fighter jets to, and the Saudis want to fund. Perhaps the whole process of the All India NRC can be privatized, including the data bank with our iris scans. The employment opportunities and accompanying profits might even revive our dying economy. The detention centers could be built by the Indian equivalents of Siemens, Bayer, and IG Farben. Even if we don't get to the Zyklon B stage, there's plenty of money to be made. We can only hope that someday soon, the streets of India will throng with people who realize that unless they make their move, the end is close. If that doesn't happen, consider these words to be intimations of an ending from one who lived through these times. Thank you.
That was Arundhati Roy on Modi's India. She spoke in New York in mid-November 2019. Arundhati Roy of India is a world-renowned writer. Her latest book is My Seditious Heart. This program is produced by Alternative Radio based in Boulder, Colorado. Now in its 34th year, we are independent and part of the nonprofit organization Rise Up. We are supported solely by individuals just like you. Every week, we feature progressive voices rarely heard in the corporate media, such as Vijay Prashad, Sanjay Kak, Nader Hashmi, and Noam Chomsky. And we have a series of programs featuring Arundhati Roy. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. To place a credit card order for CDs, MP3s, or written transcripts of today's program, Arundhati Roy on Modi's India, call us at 1-800-444-1977. Again, that number is 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order on our website, alternativeradio.org. Theme music is performed by the Kronos Quartet from Pieces of Africa. Special thanks to Anthony Arnov and to the Type Media Center. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.